rest of the film, they were driven forward by the momentum of a new generation taking over the comedy world and turning the old tropes upside down. When John Landis was hired to direct the movie, there was some friction between John and the writers. IMDb quotes my dad as saying, "John sort of referred immediately to Animal House as my movie. We'd been living with it for 2 years, and we hated that." My dad was also mad that John refused to cast him in the movie. "Fuck that. I'm not hanging around to be an extra," I believe were his exact words in an interview years later. But at the end of the day, those were not things he often mentioned when discussing Animal House. Overwhelmingly, he recalled what a great time he had writing with Doug and Chris and how the movie was always more to him than gross-out gags and gratuitous sex. Watching the film now, I find it fascinating how quickly culture can change. What seemed innocently edgy then is borderline horrifying now. Would anyone today laugh at a 13-year-old girl getting dead drunk at a frat party and being returned home naked in a shopping cart? Maybe a sociopath yucking it up to marathons of Law & Order Special Victims Unit, but the average person, probably not. Or the scene that was supposedly based on an actual experience of my dad's, where Otter and the gang end up in a nightclub filled with scary black people whose physicality and sexuality are so threatening as to cause our heroes to run screaming from the building? No. Just no. Now, to be clear, I'm not saying these things out of some knee-jerk PC reaction to humor that walks the line between edgy and offensive. To be honest, I reject the idea of political correctness because I think it minimizes the importance of actual sensitivity to racism, sexism, and homophobia. But I do wish my dad were here to deconstruct some of the more problematic choices he made in Animal House and elsewhere. In any case, the commercial success of Animal House provided tremendous validation of the appeal of this new brand of comedy, and an incredible jumpstart to my dad's career, however sophomoric it may have been. Wink, wink. While John Landis's refusal to cast him as Boone may have reinforced the insecurities my dad had about himself as an actor, it also propelled him toward directing as a means to greater overall creative control. It Takes a Village. Jews don't really have godparents in the strict sense of the term, as in a person who's officially designated to be responsible for your spiritual life, but I was blessed with two sets, godparents and fairy godparents. My godparents are Bill Murray and Mary Jane Rosenfeld, my mom's best friend from college. My mom says they chose Bill because he was tall and funny, but then had second thoughts after the fact. "Bill liked to use you as a prop," my mom explained. "He would carry you around like a sack of potatoes and make everyone laugh, but then he wouldn't pay attention to you for the rest of the day." "But what did you want from him?" I asked. "To be like an uncle?" "No, nothing, I guess. We didn't imagine it would be a very important role. Maybe we should have given it a little more thought." "I'll say." My dad once said of Bill, "It's his job to defy all your expectations." So I guess the bar was set pretty low. Still, I wonder, is there a law against absentee godparents? What if my spiritual well-being were at stake? Can I take Bill to emotional claims court to get retroactive advice on life? Collect on all the ungiven birthday gifts? I joke, of course, but it would have been nice to have him around more over the years. My fairy godmother was Gilda Radner, who liked to refer to me as a trick baby, meaning I was so cute and easy that I tricked people into wanting to have kids. Gilda died in 1989, tragically, and my memories of her from childhood are few. Mostly I remember her making funny faces at me and laughing with my dad. My fairy godfather is Andy Kay, a dancer and painter who teaches Zen brushwork in Hawaii, where he lives with his husband, together for 40 years. Andy travels the world teaching and making art and generously painted the huppa for my wedding. Andy is the only godparent who has really been actively involved in my life, and it's been a real blessing to have such a magical and loving person looking out for me. Aside from the appointed godparents, fairy or otherwise, I was lucky to always be surrounded by a lot of smart and funny adults. Doug Kenny was a major presence in the first few years of my life, and I remember him singing me a very silly version of the alphabet song where he would just inject random words. A, B, C, D, E, F, nosegay, H-I-J-K-L-M-N-O, galoshes. P-Q-R-S-T-U, violet. You are such a pumpernickel pie. He had a great energy, and I always loved when he was around, as did my dad. Because I was around adults most of the time, I was what you would call a precocious child. At age 2, I could recite the Owl and the Pussycat from memory and liked to sing Cole Porter songs with my mom. When I was a bit older, I thought nothing of chatting it up with complete strangers. We took you everywhere, my mom tells me. Once at a restaurant when you were 4, we noticed you'd left our table and found you sitting with 2 men in suits, holding court, talking about who knows what, while they both stared at you enthralled. On airplanes, my parents let me wander around and would find me an hour later sitting with someone looking at their family photos or telling them about my life. My mom remembers Doug Kenny watching me eat a big bowl of popcorn in front of the TV when I was about 3 and saying, "She's already an adolescent." My dad loved to tell the story of watching the evening news with me when I was 4 or 5, when a story came on about gay scoutmasters. "What's that?" I asked. "Well, gay is when a man loves a man or a woman loves a woman, like..." "I know that, Daddy," I said, cutting him off. "What's a scoutmaster?" I became obsessed with human reproduction at an early age. When I was around 5, someone, probably my mom, had the bright idea to show me The Miracle of Life, a PBS documentary that started with infrared shots of people and their hormones walking down a busy city street and ending with a close-up of a baby's slimy head emerging from a bushy vagina. It was my favorite movie, and I watched it over and over again. The slightest questioning, I would go into a mini-lecture on the function of the vas deferens and the epididymis. At some point, one of my mom's artist friends wanted to put me in a little nurse's uniform and have me narrate The Miracle of Life, Mystery Science Theater 3000 style. This obsession with baby-making led to another favorite pastime of mine, the birth game. This was a game I made up that started with a phone call from the doctor's office. "Congratulations, you're pregnant," followed by cramming increasingly larger stuffed animals into my dress as I waddled around the house and ending with me on my back, legs up, screaming with labor pains until I delivered a teddy bear. "But sound happy when you tell me. It's a boy," I would instruct whoever was lucky enough to get roped into playing the doctor. Maybe that's why we seem to go through so many babysitters. Can you imagine? Oy. Another game, which I would only make my dad play with me, was How Old? It was like the down and dirty version of Que Sera Sera. "When I was just a little girl, I asked my mother, 'What will I be?'" For 7-year-olds, I would say, "What if I like a boy?" And he would say, "But you're too young." And I would say, "Well, how old do I have to be?" And then he would go through the ages at which things would be acceptable. At 12, I was allowed to hold hands. At 13, I could kiss on the lips. 14, French kiss. 15, petting. Does anyone even say petting anymore? 16, sex. 16 might seem early, but I think everyone was just hoping that I would even wait that long. For the record, I didn't. Sorry. I don't know why I liked this game, if you could even call it that. I guess I was looking for some kind of boundaries. In the early 80s, my parents got connected with this very cool downtown new wave art scene in L.A. Doug Kenny had introduced them to Peter Ivers, a brilliant musician and performer who had created the TV show New Wave Theater, wrote the soundtrack for Eraserhead with David Lynch, and shot some very cool experimental videos for his music. He and my mom were very close and studied yoga together under the same teacher, Alan Finger. My dad co-produced one of Peter's last projects, a musical revue called Vitamin Pink, performed at Club Lingerie on the Sunset Strip in June of 1982. I played the part of the child and sang with Peter, Rochelle Robertson, and Tequila Mockingbird. We rehearsed for weeks in Peter's huge loft. I can't remember the gist of the show, but on my cue, topless in a white satin miniskirt and a sequined turban, I was borne through a plastic tunnel and right into my solo song. I personally inherited $100 million, and I can do what I want to, do what I want, and I may be a child, but I can do what I want to, do what I want. I felt so cool going to school the day after the show. I refused to wash the makeup off my face, so I looked like a 6-year-old party girl on her walk of shame back to the playground. I yawned often and deliberately that day so people would ask me why I was so tired. Oh, I would say offhandedly, I was in a show last night at Club Lingerie, and I didn't get home until after midnight. I loved the whole scene, and I couldn't wait for Peter to write the next show so we could do it all over again. Tragically, Peter was found murdered in his loft on March 3, 1983, rounding out a heartbreaking trio starting with Doug's death in 1980 and John Belushi's in 1982. My parents were devastated. I will never forget the image of them standing together in the doorway of my school, my mother's face pale and crumpled, my father looking uncharacteristically somber. "Peter's dead," my mother choked out. "No more vitamin pink?" I asked, thinking only of myself. They both started weeping. "He was such a great guy," my dad sobbed, tears raining down on his turquoise polo shirt. Of course, I had no idea at the time that my dad had been questioned by police for hours that morning, that my mom was completely heartbroken, or that, beyond our family friend, the world had lost another truly genius creative force. Being raised in the smoky, coked-up, pre-AIDS pandemonium of early 1980s Hollywood could have been a total disaster for my early development, but it wasn't. I used to think I had saved myself by skipping childhood entirely and going right to mini adult, but I realize now this isn't really the case, or at least not the whole story. My dad, despite his vices, was committed to being a good father and never seemed to let his work or play take priority over me. My mother, for all of her issues as a parent, was at least immune to the superficial bullshit of celebrity life and made sure I was exposed to as many interesting people and things as possible. The hodgepodge of adults who rounded out my coterie of caretakers and role models were, in many ways, often very childlike themselves, exuberant, wild, whimsical, and prone to tantrums. On the one hand, this group of rowdy geniuses meant great fun for me as a kid. On the other hand, it likely skewed my perspective on adulthood, creativity, success, and security, and definitely was an early introduction to the ambiguity that would become a refrain in my bizarre yet normal life. Famous people are just people. Good people do bad things. Bad things happen to good people. Life is messy. Caddyshack, 1980. Written by Harold Ramis, Doug Kenny, and Brian Doyle Murray. Directed by Harold Ramis. Danny Noonan, Michael O'Keefe, an ambitious teen from a blue-collar family, works as a caddy at the snooty Bushwood Country Club to earn money for college. To increase his chances of receiving a coveted scholarship, Noonan volunteers to caddy for Judge Smales, Ted Knight, an influential old-money club member who is at war with the crass nouveau riche Al Cervic, Rodney Dangerfield. As Danny prepares for the Caddy Day golf tournament that will make or break his college dreams, he receives philosophical guidance from eccentric and wealthy playboy Ty Webb, Chevy Chase. Ty Webb: "There's a force in the universe that makes things happen, and all you have to do is get in touch with it, stop thinking, let things happen, and be the ball." The first-time director, Harold Ramis, can't hold it together. The picture lurches from style to style, including some ill-placed whimsy with a gopher puppet, and collapses somewhere between sitcom and sketch farce. Dave Kerr, Chicago Reader. Caddyshack never finds a consistent comic note of its own, but it plays host to all sorts of approaches from its stars, who sometimes hardly seem to be occupying the same movie. Roger Ebert, Chicago Sun-Times. A pleasantly loose-limbed sort of movie with some comic moments, most of them belonging to Mr. Dangerfield. Vincent Canby, The New York Times. Caddyshack came on the heels of the success of Animal House and offered my dad and Doug Kenny another chance at developing their nascent brand of what my dad called institutional comedy, basically youth revolting against the establishment. Brian Doyle Murray, Bill's older brother and a close friend of my dad's from the Second City days, had been a caddy in Winnetka as a teenager, and Doug's father was a tennis pro in Ohio, so they had an inside perspective on the class and cultural dynamics of the country club world. My dad had never golfed before, but as a nerdy Jew, he easily identified with the conflict between insiders and outsiders. While the early drafts of the screenplay focused solidly on the Danny Noonan character, as the star-studded cast came together, My dad saw the story evolving from a standard Bildungsroman into being more about the four adult role models, and how Danny would ultimately choose which path to take and what kind of man he wanted to become. In many ways, Caddyshack was also a coming of age for my dad. He was confident and ambitious, but had not gone to film school, had never directed before, and had to figure out what he was doing on the fly. In a draft of a piece he wrote for the Directors Guild of America, he recalled the first day of shooting. I walked on the set of Caddyshack and made a total fool of myself on the first setup. We were shooting on a golf course in Davie, Florida, and the AD asked where I wanted to put the camera. I could feel the whole crew staring at me, the first-time director, waiting to see what kind of leader I'd be. I looked around and saw nothing but green, nothing but trees and manicured fairways all around, so I arbitrarily pointed, that way. The AD looked in the direction I was pointing and squinted. Apparently, he noticed something I hadn't. So you want us to move the generator, the catering tent, and all the trucks? 'Cause they'll be in the shot. Oh, is that what all that stuff is? No, let's leave that where it is. I could see the smirks on the faces of the grips, and that's when I learned a great lesson of directing. If you don't know, ask. Where do you think we should put the camera? I asked Steve Larner, the DP. From that moment on, everything ran smoothly, with the understanding that I knew nothing and should not be consulted on anything technical. I was only 2 when Caddyshack was being filmed in Florida, but I have rich, if fragmented, memories of our time in Fort Lauderdale. Thousands of small frogs clinging to the window of our hotel room during Hurricane David, the day they filmed the explosions on the golf course, playing with Minerva Perez, the young caddy in drag in the film, making my big debut in the movie and feeling like a star. If you blink, you'll miss it, but in the scene on the dock, I'm the pipsqueak in a sailor suit making faces at Michael O'Keefe until my mom comes and carries me away. According to my mom, I knew everyone's name on the crew, from the caterers to the costumers to the producers to the guy who stocked the vending machine. At the time, I was unaware of the late-night parties, drug use, and other shenanigans going on, but there was a loose circus-like atmosphere on set that allowed me to ramble around and feel right at home. After Animal House, Dad and Doug expected Caddyshack to be a huge success, which it wasn't, and Doug took the criticism very hard. Unfortunately, he died before he could see what a beloved classic it became, but my dad was always amused by how enthusiasm for the film evolved over time. Back when people used to read TV Guide, Caddyshack was a 2-star movie for the first 10 years. Then at some point, I noticed that it got a 3rd star in the same publication, and I thought, maybe it's like wine. The longer you keep it, it just gets a little better. I happen to love Caddyshack, even though, like Animal House, it has some cringe-inducing elements. Could there have been one funny woman with more than a throwaway line? Apparently not. And Lacey Underall, really? Come on, Dad. Putting that aside, I feel like its messiness is kind of charming and clearly reflects the fact that my dad had no prior directing experience. He often said in his later years that he found it unwatchable because all he could ever see were the mistakes and missed opportunities. But despite that, he always enjoyed Caddyshack's popularity and endless quotability. After my dad died, even Barack Obama, or whoever wrote his press releases, couldn't help himself, releasing this statement. Michelle and I were saddened to hear of the passing of Harold Ramis, one of America's greatest satirists, and like so many other comedic geniuses, a proud product of Chicago's Second City. When we watched his movies, from Animal House and Caddyshack to Ghostbusters and Groundhog Day, we didn't just laugh until it hurt. We questioned authority, we identified with the outsider, we rooted for the underdog, and through it all, we never lost our faith in happy endings. Our thoughts and prayers are with Harold's wife, Erica, his children and grandchildren, and all those who loved him, who quote his work with abandon, and who hope that he received total consciousness. I know Dad would have loved that. Tell me about when you were little. I always loved to hear my dad's stories of his childhood. He remembered every small detail and acted out stories with voices, like the impression he did of a neighborhood girl who was always trying to get my dad and his brother in trouble and would yell, "Harold and Stephen's mother!" at the top of her nasal voice from the sidewalk in front of their building. He had a real affection for his family and other characters from that time in his life, and it shone through when he spoke about them. My grandmother Ruth was the second of five children born to Fanny and Hyman Cokey. Rose, Ruth, Harold, who passed away as a child, Jordan, and Shelley. Each of them had two or three children, and that generation in turn went on to have three to five children each. It was a big, warm, and wonderful family. Bubby, my great-grandmother, was the heart of the clan. She would beam at her children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, her love evident in her eyes. "I'm so proud," she would whisper. "I'm so, so proud." Then she would spit on the floor and say a Kenahora to ward off the evil eye. Bubby came from Kiev at 17 years old and worked in a fish market in Kentucky when she first arrived in the States. She never learned to read or write in English, but that didn't stop her from living a full life. My dad told me that once, when she was watching him and his brother Stephen, they had gotten separated from her and taken the wrong L train and got lost. He said he hadn't realized what was going on at first because he couldn't imagine not feeling completely safe and taken care of with her. And that story always stuck with me because she made me feel that way too. She was a great lady who made fruitcake and farfel from scratch well into her 90s and passed away peacefully at 97. To hear my dad tell it, his childhood in Chicago in the 1950s was like a Jewish working-class Norman Rockwell world with a little Lord of the Flies thrown in for good measure. He and his brother Stephen roamed the streets with their gang like the little rascals, collecting bottle caps and other junk that could be used as toys or traded for a few pennies. When Eric Spitznagel asked my dad about his childhood for The Believer in 2006, he talked about being independent from an early age. "I was the little guy who knew how to tie a necktie. It came from having absentee parents. They were tremendously loving and caring people who, by circumstance, had to go to work. So my brother and I were latchkey kids, left to ourselves. Instead of turning that into a delightful delinquency, we became overly responsible." As children, he and Stephen often cooked dinner to have it ready and waiting when their parents came home from work. I was endlessly curious about life in olden times, and Dad would humor me by describing family meals, cheerfully arguing over who would get the last lamb chop, what snacks he ate after school, a gallon of milk, a box of cookies, and a whole salami he would devour like a banana. Working in the family store, the time his mother sliced the tip off her thumb behind the butcher counter, and other neighborhood kids. Playing buck-buck, a brutal game where boys crouched down in a line and then jumped onto each other's backs, digging elbows and knees into kidneys. During my own sadistic phase of fascination with hurt stories, I asked, "Didn't you ever break any bones or have to go to the hospital?" And he recalled that when he was around 7, roaming the streets with his brother and their posse, Stephen spotted a piece of chain link in a pile of ashes and excitedly grabbed it, not realizing that it was white hot from a fire and severely burning his hands. Ouch. When I was in the mood for stories about romance, Dad offered the tale of his first crush, Joanne Grapey, for whom he gathered all of his savings and bought a rhinestone necklace in second grade. Unfortunately, she did not have feelings for him and threw the necklace on the ground, trampling his little heart along with the rhinestones. I wonder if she later regretted her decision. I have to say, I kind of hope it haunted her forever. One moral of the story fable from his childhood that he told repeatedly was about telling the truth. I first heard the story of the mirror following the only spanking my dad ever gave me. I was about 6 and thought it would be a good idea to cut my own hair. I stood on the toilet so I could see myself in the mirror and just chopped away. Then I went on about my business and thought that was the end of it. Later, my dad came to me and asked, "Violet, did you cut your hair?" "No, Daddy." "Are you sure? I found all this hair in the bathroom wastebasket." "Are you sure you didn't cut your hair?" "Nope. Maybe Mom did. Yeah, I think Mom cut her hair." "Okay, I'll go talk to Mom then." "Okay." Looking back, I don't know how I thought I was going to get away with it. My hair was about 6 inches shorter on one side, and obviously my mom had not cut her hair, and I was about to tell my dad that. He came back a few minutes later and said, "Violet, I'm going to ask you one more time. Did you cut your hair?" "No," I said, digging in. "I did not cut my hair. I'm not even supposed to use the big scissors," I added, as if that was going to help my case. "Well, I know you're lying," he said tightly, his nostrils starting to flare, "and I'm going to have to punish you. I'm going to spank you 10 times, and you're going to count." Cue record scratch. What? My dad had never hit me before, and I couldn't believe he was going to now. He led me into the living room, laid me over his knees, and proceeded to spank me on the butt 10 times while I counted. It didn't hurt, but I cried anyway. Then when it was done, he sat me up, kissed away my tears, and told me about the mirror. When my dad and Stephen were 6 and 7, my grandmother was cleaning their apartment and had pushed all of the furniture to the middle of the room. While she was in the kitchen, they played a forbidden game of indoor tag, jumping from couch to chair to coffee table. A full-length mirror that was propped against the back of the couch tipped over onto the carpet and silently shattered into a million pieces. They stood open-mouthed, scrambling to think of possible stories of how it happened. Maybe someone came in the apartment and broke it. Who? I don't know. A robber? That's dumb. Okay, what if we just say we were sitting there watching TV and it broke? She's not stupid. She'll know we're lying. So they walked solemnly into the kitchen, holding hands, and said, "Ma, we broke the mirror." "Was Grandma mad?" I asked. Well, she wasn't happy, but she knew we felt terrible about it and was proud that we told the truth. "Did you get in trouble?" "No, she figured we would torture ourselves enough." This torture-yourself approach seemed to work for my dad, both as a kid and as an adult. It's basically personal responsibility with a dash of Jewish guilt. Don't do it because I say so, do it because you know it's the right thing, and I will be so disappointed if you don't. This was his strategy at home and on set, where, as the director, he was like a father to the whole crew. We all wanted to do our best for him, not because he would be mad if we didn't, but because we would be mad at ourselves if we let him down. I teased him about the haircut incident for years. "How could you have hit me like that and made me count? So mean." "I didn't know what I was doing," he'd laugh. "It seemed like the right thing to do, and it worked, didn't it? You never lied to me again after that, right?" Moving right along. Maybe my all-time favorite of the Young Herald stories was about my dad's first day of first grade. Little Hershey Ramis, I'm imagining him in knickers and a newsboy cap, but it was around 1950, so more realistically a little collared button-down, made the mistake of chewing gum in class. The teacher told him, "Oh no, we don't chew gum in first grade. Go back to kindergarten." He described that he left the classroom and had started walking down the hall when he realized his kindergarten teacher had gotten married and left the school. He felt so humiliated he started walking home. "But Daddy," I'd say, "you were really little. That's so sad." "It was actually kind of a life changer," he said. "There I am walking home thinking, well, there goes college. And I get home and tell my mother what happened. Well, you know how tough she was. She marched me back to school, went straight into the principal's office, and let him have it. I think the teacher got in some trouble, too, but who knows? I certainly didn't have a problem with her for the rest of the year." "Grandma Ruth to the rescue," I laughed. "Something like that," he smiled. "But it made me realize 2 important things, that getting in trouble wasn't the end of the world, and that authority figures were not always right." While these stories offer some insight into the formation of my father's parenting philosophies and general worldview, he often spoke about his childhood as it related to the development of his comedic perspective. His standard one-liner when asked if he had been a class clown was, "I wrote for the class clown." But he frequently referred to the absurd child syndrome as the process through which his humor originated. He elaborated on the idea in the Believer interview, saying, "There was a great construct I once heard about, the absurd child syndrome. Parents tell us things to protect us, or they educate us from their own misinformation or misconceptions. We tell our kids that policemen are good and God protects us and our country is noble. And at a certain point, for some of us it comes quite early, at 5 or 6 years old, we start to realize that it's all a facade. So a child says, well, sheesh, the institutions that I'm supposed to respect are telling me things that don't appear to be true. Either I'm crazy or they're crazy." That creates the absurd child. The absurd child is one who says, well, I think they're crazy. So you live in this state of alienation from your culture and your society and your family because you see this rampant bullshit around you. Some people have a fear of rejecting all the security that comes with family, church, and state. They become fundamentalists. In a lot of ways, every child is a miniature fundamentalist. They need to believe in these things. It's too terrifying otherwise. It takes maturity to embrace all that ambiguity. Once you're alienated, you're on your own. This absurdity, the hypocrisy of authority, arbitrary morality, and often societal expectations, was a major theme throughout my dad's personal life and is clearly reflected in much of his work. It significantly influenced his parenting choices with me and shaped my worldview in an entirely different way. Whereas he grew up with and eventually rebelled against standard, binary, black and white models of thinking and living, I was raised in an endless gray area, left to form my own conclusions about right, wrong, and the kind of person I wanted to be. Thankfully, both of my parents provided distinct and dynamic models of how to do this, and although I'm probably more of a fundamentalist than either one of them, their encouragement to draw outside the lines made me the person I am today. Grown-up stuff. My dad smoked. A lot. Vantage 100s by the carton and pot pretty much by the pound throughout my early childhood. Say what you will about irresponsible parenting, but I think smoking grass helped him be the infinitely patient, playful, and peaceful dad that he was. It's not that he had to be high to play dolls with me for hours, but I'm sure he enjoyed it more with a little buzz. I remember watching him cleaning seeds and stems out of a big plastic baggie and then effortlessly rolling joint after joint until he had a little collection neatly lined up in front of him. Always a perfectionist. He called them French cigarettes. When I was young, I didn't really have an understanding of drugs. I just knew it was a part of what he did, and so I never questioned it. While I climbed around on the rickety swing set in our backyard, he lovingly tended to a scrawny little pot plant that never quite took off. At night, I often faked a stomach ache so I could get out of bed and sit with him on the couch while he got high and watched movies. Long before I had any clue what it was all about, I would switch into that holding-in-smoke voice to make a joke, much to the amusement or confusion of my audience, depending on who they were. Once, someone dropped off a big plate of brownies that I, of course, was very excited to eat after dinner. When I'd finished my standard evening meal of hot dogs and tater tots, I asked my dad where they were, and he told me, "I'm sorry, baby. Those are for grown-ups only." After that, whenever offered sweets, I would ask, "Are they grown-up cookies, or are they okay for kids?" Looking back, I wonder what my friend's parents made of this. I guess if it wasn't a secret from me, it wasn't a secret from anyone. Now, the fear of being reported to children's services is so strong, I can't imagine being as open with my kids as he was with me. Since we're talking about drugs, we might as well round out the twin pillars of parental discomfort and talk about sex, too. I guess you could say that my parents had an arrangement or understanding when it came to their marriage. My dad had been my mom's first boyfriend, and they got married so young, neither one of them had much opportunity to get out there in the world on their own. As I've said before, my mom was and is unconventional to the core. For her part, she honestly was okay with Dad having sex with other women as long as he came home to her. From his perspective, he wanted her to be happy and didn't take it personally if she was turned on, intellectually, creatively, or sexually by other men. I think it also made him feel less guilty about his own behavior if she was doing it too. In any event, he slept with a lot of women outside their marriage, and she had a couple of long-term affairs. They each knew what the other person was doing, and each respected each other enough to let them be who they needed to be and do who they needed to do. Although there were some special friends who would be around for a while and then disappear, I rightfully was not privy to any of these details as a kid, and didn't fully understand the inner workings of their relationship until long after they had divorced. What I was aware of, and what became an ingrained part of my own belief system, was the fluidity and acceptance of deviation when it came to social norms. This is not to say that my parents' relationship was all roses or that no one ever felt hurt or confused or angry. I am also not saying that everyone should do drugs around their children and damn the consequences. What I am saying is this. My parents had beliefs, needs, and habits that fell outside of the generally accepted boundaries of marriage, home, and family. Because of this, they modeled behavior and set expectations around honesty and authenticity, rather than blind acceptance of the rules. I mean, let's face it, it was never going to be Leave It to Beaver with these two. They were who they were, warts and all, and those warts were as much a part of their parenting as anything else. I've made different choices in my own life and family, but I appreciate their example of an alternative lifestyle because it gave me an expansive view of the gray areas of life and a much wider definition of what is okay and acceptable than I ever could have had otherwise. Stripes, 1981. Written by Len Blum, Daniel Goldberg, and Harold Ramis. Directed by Ivan Reitman. Chicago cabbie John Winger, Bill Murray, is failing at life. His response to being fired from his job and dumped by his girlfriend is to enlist in the U.S. Army with his best friend, Russell Ziske, Harold Ramis. After they barely make it through basic training under the watchful eye of Sergeant Hulka, Warren Oates, Winger's and Ziske's military skills are put to the test when their oddball platoon is captured and held prisoner behind enemy lines. Russell: you could join a monastery. John: did you ever see a monk get wildly fucked by some teenage girls? Russell: never. John: so much for the monastery. An anarchic slob movie, a celebration of all that is irreverent, reckless, foolhardy, undisciplined, and occasionally scatological. It's a lot of fun. Roger Ebert, Chicago Sun-Times. Mr. Murray hasn't yet reached the point at which his routine can be sustained for more than 10 minutes at a time, but he has achieved a sardonically exaggerated calm that can be very entertaining. Janet Maslin, New York Times. Stripes, originally written for Cheech and Chong, attracted the attention of Ivan Reitman, who had just come off directing Meatballs. He wanted Bill to star and figured that if he could get my dad involved, Bill would be more likely to commit to the film. According to The New Yorker, Ivan thought, Harold is my secret weapon. Bill is this great improv player, but he needs Harold, the focused composer who understands setting a theme and the rules of orchestration. So I told Harold, one, I want you to co-star in my movie, and two, I want you to rewrite it for two really intelligent guys, you and Bill. So, Dr. Jokes, as my dad was known from his Playboy Second City days, agreed to get on board and turned a generic army buddy fish-out-of-water comedy into something more thoughtful and relatable. Russell Ziske is my personal favorite of all my dad's on-screen roles because I can really see him acting. Even though he's playing Bill's reasonable sidekick, he's clearly doing his version of cool. Next time you watch Stripes, notice all that head bobbing, those sly glances, and the many small gestures and expressions that you wouldn't pick up on if you were paying attention to anything other than him. There are a lot of great performances in Stripes. John Candy, John Larroquette, Warren Oates. But for me, Dad steals the show. When discussing the character, he said, I hear people describe that character as a nerd, but he wasn't a nerd at all. He was a cool guy. I got Sean Young in that movie. That Ziske was my dad's version of a cool guy, and that Sean Young was such a prize back then, should tell you a lot about what was going on in 1981. Stripes was filmed in Kentucky on the Fort Knox Army Base at an abandoned distillery and in Louisville proper. I was almost 4 and wasn't on set as much as I had been with his other films. I do remember spending time with the girls, PJ Souls and Sean Young, in the hair and makeup trailer, and I remember being devastated and hysterical the day my dad cut his hair. My dramatic response was partly because I was an obsessive twiddler, meaning I loved to play with hair, my own and others. My dad always had great hair, thick, soft, and lots of it. I would suck my thumb and wind my fingers into his curls, and that was all I needed in life. So when this person walked into our rented house with my dad's face and voice, but with this weird short hair, I couldn't understand it. I cried and ran from him when he tried to pick me up. Not only was I sad to lose my security blanket, I was also terrified by how foreign he suddenly looked. Again, surprise, surprise, there was a lot of drug use going on at the time that I wasn't aware of, but which my dad told me about later. For example, one morning, Dad, John Candy, and John Larroquette were done with hair and makeup and were all hanging out in my dad's trailer waiting to get called to set. My dad brought out a joint, and they all smoked. Then someone decided it would be a good idea to drink a bottle of cognac, so they did. They were so out of it, they weren't sure if they'd be able to do their scene, so someone suggested they do some cocaine to sober up. Feeling better after that, my dad looked at his watch and it was only 8 a.m. Do-wah-diddy-diddy-dum-diddy-do. The success of Stripes kept my dad's string of hits rolling, but I don't think he felt the same ownership of it that he had with Animal House and Caddyshack. It was Ivan's movie, Bill was the star, and my dad was there, as usual, to provide the brainy straight man for Bill to play off of. In many ways, Stripes seems like a warm-up for Ghostbusters. They needed that less cynical outlier and a more original story, both of which Dan Aykroyd provided, to push them to the next level. My dad, my hero. Whenever I was sick as a child, my dad was the best nurse. He would hold my hair back as I threw up, murmuring reassurances while I cried. I have a very vivid memory of him, cigarette dangling from his lips as he wiped down the bathroom walls after a particularly virulent stomach bug. Once my nausea settled, he would make me his special socky eggs. They were really soft-boiled eggs, which I misheard as sock-boiled eggs, and then shortened to socky. For a long time, I actually thought that he boiled the eggs in socks. Either way, it was yolky and delicious and always made me feel better. Incidentally, it's also good for a hangover if you can stomach the runny egg. Harold's Sick Kid Socky Egg Recipe. Make toast. Butter the toast. Cut toast into small squares. Soft boil 2 eggs, 2 to 3 minutes in boiling water. Scoop out the runny eggs and mix with the toast squares until everything is nice and yolky. Add salt. Eat. Smile. My mom, no Florence Nightingale but doing her best, would recycle the same get-well card every time I got sick. It was a painting of a distinguished-looking black cat in bed with an ice pack on his head and a thermometer sticking out of his mouth. In it, she wrote in her sprawling, loopy script, "Hope you feel better real soon. Love, Annie." Strangely, I don't have very many significant memories of my parents together. We lived together in a little house, 437 11th Street in Santa Monica, until I was 6, 1983. There was a huge evergreen tree and hydrangeas in the front yard, and avocado and lemon trees in the back. A rickety redwood swing set with exposed nails was the only real concession to childhood outside of my room. I played in the mud and ate the small, tart strawberries that grew alongside the driveway. Mom converted the garage into an art studio, and I would skip and dance around, often alone, in a fantasy world. There were 3 other families that made up the bulk of our family social sphere. The Schambergs, the Ruckers, and the Gricos. They all had kids around the same age, and we'd get together often for barbecues, Easter egg hunts, and 4th of July picnics. My parents and I took vacations together and did day-to-day stuff, but I don't have a picture in my mind of the two of them together when I think parents. They separated when I was about 8, so maybe it's because they tag-team parented me that the 3 of us weren't actually together very often. Or maybe it's just that my dad's light burned so bright it eclipsed pretty much everything else. Either way, the memory of them together that stands out most in my mind is of a fight. When I was about 5, my parents and I went to someone's art-themed birthday party where the parting gifts were crayon-shaped soaps. I had an idea to try to trick someone into attempting to draw using the soaps, but I needed to cover the large soap on the label. I went into the junk drawer and cut 2 1-inch pieces of double stick tape off the roll. I took the crayons to my mom with a glimmer in my eye, asking her, "Will you draw me a picture with these?" She immediately homed in on the tape and demanded, "Where did you get this?" "From the tape drawer?" I answered tremulously, taken aback by my mom's sudden anger. "Who said you could use this tape?" "No one." She demanded that I give her $2 to replace the tape, which was about all I had in my piggy bank at the time. Whimpering, I walked into the kitchen to give her the money. My dad, as usual, was writing at the table with legal pads everywhere and his customary coffee and full ashtray. "What happened?" he asked. "I used 2 pieces of double stick tape and Mom got mad and said I have to give her $2. At this point, my mom took the money from my hand and walked out of the room. My dad told me not to cry, picked up the tape, and followed my mom into their bedroom, where he unraveled the entire roll in her face. Enraged, she charged back into the kitchen and attempted to sweep all of his papers onto the floor. He grabbed her from behind as she flailed around, and I hid behind the wall, partially confused, partially terrified, and partially pleased as pie that my dad had stood up for me. My knight in shining khakis. This kind of physical fight was definitely a one-off for my parents. Sure, they argued from time to time, but mostly they seemed to cut each other a lot of slack. I think this particular fight stands out so vividly for me because it was so uncharacteristically intense and seemed to come out of nowhere. On a happier note, our semi-nomadic lifestyle brought us to New York often when I was small, for a mix of business and pleasure. I remember being so excited and feeling very much like Eloise, superimposing my imaginary world over the city. We always went to Tender Buttons, an amazing store full of nothing but buttons, and the Dead Zoo, also known as the American Museum of Natural History. Brian and Anne McConaughey, friends of my parents from the Lampoon days, were a staple of the smart, funny, cool cadre of adults in my world. Brian, years ahead of his time, would greet me with, "Hail to thee, computer generation," and taught me to respond, "Hail to thee, baby boomers." We spent a lot of time with them and their daughter Mary, who was a few years younger than me, whenever we were in the city. During one visit, the Anns went to see a show, and Brian and my dad took Mary and me to a maze at Lincoln Center. I remember the bright primary colors of the plastic tunnels against the endless gray concrete of the plaza. Lost and unable to find my way out of the twists and turns, I panicked, sat in the corner, and peed in my pants. Someone saw me crying and led me out. I flung myself into my dad's arms as if I had been on the brink of death. "What's wrong, baby? What happened? Did someone hurt you?" I shook my head, too embarrassed to say, and pointed to my dripping pants. I could see he was trying not to be annoyed as he hugged me. "Don't worry," he said. "It happens." "Did it ever happen to you?" I asked hopefully. "Oh yeah," he said, "all the time. In fact, I just bought these pants because I peed in the other ones while I was waiting for you." "Oh, Daddy, that's not true," I laughed. I begged him not to tell Mary or her parents. He threw my pants in the garbage, belted my little London fog overcoat into a makeshift dress, and promised not to tell anyone. Walking down Columbus Avenue later that evening, I was feeling like the happiest, luckiest girl in the world. I looked down and saw a ruby glittering on the ground. I bent to pick up this precious gem and was shocked when it turned out to be the glowing ember of someone's discarded cigarette. Brian and Anne laughed at my grandiose imagination, and again my dad was there to kiss the tears away. They remember this story as an anecdote about a quirky girl, a fish out of water in the big city. I used to joke about it with my dad as an early step in the lowering of my expectations of life. For better or worse, my dad was always my rock, and I never grew out of running to him to kiss away my tears, even when the problems got more complicated than peeing in my pants. Ticket to Ride. My parents didn't give up their adventures just because they had a child. My dad always joked that I'd traveled halfway around the world before my first birthday, and all the way around it by the time I was 5. They first took me to Idra when I was just 9 months old, and for the last time when I was around 4. My memories of our trips are fuzzy but vivid. I remember staying in a stone house that seemed like a castle and provided an amazing backdrop for my fantasy play. Eating a huge piece of spanakopita in a cafe and the cook coming out to pinch my cheeks and give me candy. And walking through the ruins of the ancient amphitheater at Epidaurus where we could hear each other whispering from 200 feet away. I wish I could remember more from that magical place and time. The Idra story that does stand out in my mind will not endear my dad to animal lovers, but I loved hearing him tell it because it reminded me of the song "The Cat Came Back," where Mr. Johnson tries everything to get rid of his cat, but it keeps coming back. Think Wile E. Coyote and the Roadrunner. Idra was overrun with feral cats. They were everywhere. There was an orange three-legged cat that would come around the house we rented looking for food. The cat had a very loud and irritating meow that would wake my dad up at the crack of dawn almost every morning. "Meow," he would wail as he told me the story, while pantomiming grumpily getting out of bed to shoo the thing away as I dissolved into giggles. Unwilling to just accept the early wake-up call, my dad wrapped the cat in a blanket and carried it to the other side of the island, hoping it would find a new house to beg from. But the cat came back. My dad would swim in the ocean almost every day and noticed a lot of tied-up plastic bags in the water. A local fisherman at the dock told him that the bags were full of stray cats. So one day, after the yowling, he wrestled the cat into a plastic bag and started walking towards the cliff to toss it in. The cat clawed its way out of the bag and was back the next day. Finally, one night, he and my mom were having a dinner party and the cat showed up. Meow, meow, meow. Pardon me for just one moment, my dad said, ever so politely, excusing himself from the table. Then he went outside, filled a garbage can with water, threw the cat in, put the lid on, and went back to his guests. He would cringe guiltily as he recounted his final solution, but I, weirdly, liked that side of him. Behind the sweetness, there was this other thing. I guess what Robert Bly would call the shadow. I think of it as more naughty than cruel, but I guess my mean streak sought validation in his. Mr. Nice Guy wasn't always so nice after all. This is also why I loved his road rage and would cheer as he yelled, "You're a fucking menace!" out the window of his little BMW 3 Series as he sped east on the 10 freeway in L.A. When I was 5 years old, my mom, my dad, and I traveled to Bali for 2 weeks. My mom, as always, was a real adventurer and had us traveling all over the country on crowded buses to see a certain temple or wood carver or shadow puppet maker she had read about. Toward the end of our trip, we met up with PJ Souls, whom Dad had acted with in Stripes, and her then-husband, Dennis Quaid. While walking around near Ubud, we happened to encounter a large funeral procession for a local priest. There were hundreds of people in the streets, carrying offerings and playing instruments. An elaborate funeral tower was carried down the street on a bamboo frame and then set on fire, and Dad put me on his shoulders so I could see better. I remember being so shocked that someone was being cremated in public. Around the same time we were in Bali, Bill Murray also visited the Indonesian island. Dad recalled this trip in the 2004 New Yorker article, Comedy First. One of my favorite Bill Murray stories is one about when he went to Bali. I'd spent 3 weeks there, mostly in the south, where the tourists are, but Bill rode a motorcycle into the interior until the sun went down and got totally lost. He goes into a village store where they're very surprised to see an American tourist and starts talking to them in English, going, "Wow, nice hat. Hey, give me that hat." Ramus's eyes were lighting up. And he took the guy's hat and started imitating people, entertaining. Word gets around this hamlet that there's some crazy guy at the grocery, and he ended up doing a dumb show with the whole village sitting around and laughing as he grabbed the women and tickled the kids. No worry about getting back to a hotel, no need for language. Just his presence and his charisma and his courage. When you meet the hero, you sure know it. He smiled. Bill loves to get lost, to throw the map out of the window and drive till you have no idea where you are, just to experience something new. And you? Oh, I'd be the one with the map. I'm the map guy. I'm the one saying to Bill, "You know, we should get back now. They're going to be looking for us." So while my dad may not have been the type to get lost in the jungle or wander aimlessly through the world, he was always game to try something new and did enough research to know how to get himself out of any sticky situation that might arise. The memories and experiences of our early travels fill me with a sense of nostalgic longing now. Things seemed so much simpler when I was just a kid along for the ride. I didn't have to worry about making arrangements or paying for anything or the colonialist impact of my presence in countries dependent on and exploited by tourism. So while I wouldn't say I have a persistent wanderlust like my mom, I am curious about the world and happy to get in there and experience it from the comfort of a decent and reasonably priced hotel. National Lampoon's Vacation, 1983. Written by John Hughes, directed by Harold Ramis. Nothing seems to be going right when Clark Griswold, Chevy Chase, takes his family, Beverly D'Angelo, Dana Barron, and Anthony Michael Hall, on a cross-country road trip to Wally World. When Clark starts to crack under the pressure of making his wife and children happy, he becomes entranced by a beautiful woman in a red convertible and is distracted by his fantasies. As Clark's carefully planned itinerary unravels, the Griswolds are forced to deal with marital problems, car problems, the death of a family member, and one final speed bump that threatens to ruin the whole vacation. Clark Griswold. Hey, hey, easy, kids. Everybody in the car. Boat leaves in 2 minutes. Or perhaps you don't want to see the second largest ball of twine on the face of the earth, which is only 4 short hours away. Despite plenty of gross-out gags and dumb slapstick bits, the careful viewer can occasionally detect some acrid and original satire in this 1983 film. Dave Kerr, Chicago Tribune. Confident humor and throwaway style that helps sustain the laughs, of which there are quite a few. Janet Maslin, New York Times. Director Harold Ramis, who went on to make Groundhog Day, keeps the silliness coming at a fast and furious pace. Joanna Berry, Radio Times. National Lampoon's Vacation was based on Vacation 58, a story written by John Hughes that appeared in the Lampoon magazine. As Lampoon alums and fellow Chicagoans, my dad and John knew each other but weren't really friends. Hughes' short story was focused on the experiences of the 13-year-old son, but my dad was more interested in the father's character. The guy who wants to be a good dad, wants to be a good husband, but only has 2 weeks a year to do it. My dad is not credited as a writer on Vacation, but he and Chevy did a lot of work on the original Hughes script. Of that time, Chevy said, "My favorite thing about Harold was when we were rewriting Vacation. I'd sit there with a yellow legal pad and he would sit and do 2 New York Times crossword puzzles. We'd agree on the basic writing and I'd say, 'Okay, I've got it,' and hand it to him. And he'd just say, 'No.' And he'd redo it, to my chagrin. I'm doing the writing and he's doing the puzzles, and then he'd change it after we already agreed. It's not something that bothered me, it's just funny. It points out the looseness about him." During the filming of Vacation in 1982, my dad pulled me out of Montessori school and took me with him on location. The cast and crew traveled across the Southwest United States for 2 months like a gypsy caravan, covering 15 cities in 4 states. My 17-year-old cousin Pam was my babysitter, and lucky for me, she was very irresponsible. Pam was not much older than Dana Barron and Anthony Michael Hall, and we spent hours plotting various pranks against each other. Beds were short-sheeted, notes were stashed in cereal boxes, and wet toilet paper fights were waged in motel hallways late at night. I was over the moon excited to be cast as Daisy Mabel, also known as the girl without a tongue. I thought it was going to be my breakout role. The truth is, I got that part specifically because there were no lines, so I didn't have to be paid or credited. Also, I was a pretty terrible actor because I totally stick my tongue out during the scene. Something in me just couldn't resist, or maybe I was worried about getting pigeonholed as that young actress without a tongue. Either way, my acting failure is there on camera for all of eternity. My dad was both proud and a little embarrassed by Vacation. The mostly tidy narrative showed his growth as a director, but there were moments in the film I know he wasn't satisfied with. They shot a few different endings, and I think it never quite pulled together the way he wanted it to. He was also genuinely distressed by the Lost in St. Louis scene and used to cringe and apologize every time it came on. Still, Chevy and the supporting cast were fantastic, and it remains, in my mind at least, the quintessential family road trip movie. Dad and I would often quote lines from Vacation to each other because so much of it captures the ridiculousness of family dynamics. The franchise continued on without him, but I have to admit I've never seen Christmas Vacation or the recent reboot. Watching Vacation with my kids when they were young, it was as if things had come full circle. Now I'm the idiotic, but hopefully endearing parent, pointing out silly landmarks and doing everything in my power to give the kids memories to last a lifetime. Wally World, here we come. No More Tangles. Before there were American Girl dolls, there were Cabbage Patch Kids. In 1983, when I was 6, all of my friends had gotten them for Christmas, which my family didn't celebrate. I begged my parents for one for weeks. My mom thought they were ugly, and neither parent was the type to jump on the latest trend, even less the type to fight the crowds at Toys R Us on my behalf. By the time they relented, every store in Southern California was sold out. There was no internet then, no eBay, no Craigslist. There was only The Recycler, a weekly magazine of classified ads that sold everything from cars to baseball cards to dates. I remember my dad sitting at the Formica kitchen table, chain-smoking his Vantage 100s, circling all the ads for Cabbage Patch dolls with brown hair. My mom could not have been less interested in fulfilling this need of mine, so my dad and I drove more than 100 miles that weekend searching for my doll. Twice, the people had already sold their goods by the time